So the title of my talk tonight is Anchor Beyond Change. Now I might need a translation of the title. Thank you. The alternative title is easier. It's called The Wisdom of the Heart. So what I do is I'm taking a verse of the Buddha's, and I will endeavor to explain the verse and some teachings. And then as I go on, I will try to relate the teachings to life itself. So if you find the first part of the talk rather weighty, hang in, it's okay. The last part is easier. So this is one of my favorite verses by the Buddha, or from the text. All conditioned things are impermanent. They are phenomena subject to birth and death. When birth and death no longer are, the complete silencing is joy. And this was a verse spoken quite near to the Buddha's death. So just before he died, this was the verse that he spoke. So I'll read it one more time, and then I'll take the first two lines and the second two lines. All conditioned things are impermanent. They are phenomena subject to birth and death. When birth and death no longer are, the complete silencing is joy. So with the first two lines, he's speaking in terms of relative truth, the characteristic of existence, of the impermanent nature of all phenomena. When birth and death no longer are, refers to the deathless, that which was never born and does not die. The complete silencing is the silencing of all constructs, all desires. That's the overview. So, let's begin with all conditioned things are impermanent. They are phenomena subject to birth and death. When we meditate, we see the birth and death of each breath. The practice that we've been doing for days is mindfulness of breathing. The meditation technique is actually, of course, anchored in the breath, the very breath of our life. And of course, without the breath, we die. So when we start to pay attention to the breath, we notice that there's a ceaseless transformation happening. With every breath, each ever-changing moment. And so we see that the breath itself is impermanent. It's shifting, it's changing. So just as the breath comes and goes, of course, so this body comes and goes, yours and mine, and those we love. So since we've been born, we shall die. This is the impermanent nature of all conditioned phenomena, all phenomena, all things. So all objects, things, physical, material, and psychological, so all thoughts, all things psychological are also impermanent. All feelings are impermanent. Everything you can think of is part of the conditioned world. All feelings, perception, this body, the bell, the cushions, everything. They are all impermanent. They are all not self and inherently unsatisfactory. This is the teaching that we've been hearing for some days now. And I think that's been made clear. So the totality of our sense experience is not self. It is just sense experience. We make it personal by attaching the self to it, but it's simply sense experience. So far, so good. Okay. So, when we view sense experience in this way, we see the wisdom of non-clinging. Now, I'm going to read something from the Dalai Lama here. I think it's important. He says, destructive acts are motivated by disturbed states of mind, that is to say, by a mind dominated by the afflictions. And the afflictions fall into three categories, greed, hatred, and delusion. The next bit is interesting. He says, in the entire history of human society, it is these mental afflictions, these undisciplined states of mind, that underlie all of humanity's destructive acts, from the smallest act of killing a fly to the greatest atrocities of war. He goes on to say, the self at which we grasp is empty, meaning empty of existing in and of itself. We may imagine this, that this means that we as individuals with personal identities do not exist. But of course this is not the case. Our own personal experiences demonstrate that as subjects and agents of our own lives, we certainly exist. So it's not about non-existence. And then he says a sentence which I think puts the whole thing in perspective, and it's really important to understand. So this is the Dalai Lama. We must be very clear that only the self that is being grasped at as intrinsically real needs to be negated. In and of itself. Negated. Okay. I'll say it again in English. Only the self that is being grasped at, so that we grasp at with the mind, only the self we cling to, as intrinsically real. So it's our belief that the construct of self has more reality than it does. Okay, it's simply a conventional thing that we can use. We say you and me, no problem. It's clinging to the construct that's problematic. It's an error of seeing, essentially. Let's go on. The Venerable Thich Nhat Hanh says this. He says, we are here to awaken from our illusion of separateness. When separation ceases, there's connection to all things. And this connection to all things has an ethical significance for how we live, how we treat ourselves, and how we treat others. That is also really pertinent to understand. Our experience that we can have of connection to all things means that we need to live as harmlessly as possible, if you like, doing the least harm to oneself and another as possible. So that's the ethical significance. So when we start to see the impermanence of all things and the interconnectedness of all things, it has implications for how to live. And this needs to be seen rather clearly. Now let's come to the next part, the more difficult two lines. When birth and death no longer are, the complete silencing is joy. And here I'm calling on my friend Guy Armstrong, who's a Dharma teacher from the States. And he writes this fabulous book, which I'd highly recommend. It's called Emptiness. But what he writes is really clear and succinct. So we're coming to these two lines. When birth and death no longer are, the complete silencing is joy. Now, thank you. This is important. If you didn't understand the verse, you wouldn't understand the whole talk. Okay. So we start to see into the nature of things, and of course we first see the impermanent nature, we understand the ethical significance, and then we start to look deeper. Ajahn Buddhadasa, the old Thai teacher, who was one of my teachers and one of Christopher Titmus's teachers, would say that to understand impermanence by itself is not enough. We need to understand that, and then we need to look deeper, because there are deeper truths, there are other things to see. Of course, understanding impermanence is wonderful and brings incredible wisdom and depth, but then we need to keep looking, keep deepening our insights. Ajahn Jumnian, who's another of the Thai teachers from the forest tradition, speaks about his own meditation practice. It's very rare to find any of these Ajahns who speak about their practice. And he says, the best way to develop a great awareness, so this is not just ordinary sati, ordinary mindfulness, but he calls it maha sati, maha means great, is to rest your attention within that knowing space of consciousness, in the pure space of knowing. So here he's talking about resting in awareness. And when we rest in awareness, we can touch a pure space of knowing. If you understand and can rest in this pure knowing, that is the place of the deathless. From this pure consciousness that's unmoved by what arises, then you see the phenomena of the world, which all have the nature to arise and pass away. Phenomena show their dharmas of impermanence, and this other dharma is the dharma of the deathless. So as we reflect, as we deepen into our meditation practice, we get a sense or a whisper of something other than the shifting, changing nature, something other than the impermanent nature of all things. And then to go on a little, I'll read just another little section from Guy. He says, as we rest in the empty knowing, we see all the changing phenomena come and go. We do not need to follow them because we are anchoring beyond change. This resting feels like a big relief and is deeply satisfying in a way that pleasurable sense experiences are not. It is the peace. Its peace leads to a great unburdening of the heart. We have found a reliable refuge, a most reliable refuge. And then a little later he says, we are taking refuge in the fundamental nature of reality as the unsurpassable ultimate refuge. So we're taking refuge in that which is unborn, that which is not of the nature to come and go. That's where our freedom is found. The Buddha called the deathless liberation through non-clinging. So we know the deathless, we get a sense of the unborn when we stop clinging, when we don't cling to anything, and we no longer are following the arising and ceasing, the arising and ceasing. This is the hint. We simply rest into deep awareness. I told you the talk gets easier. It's okay. So this is the wisdom of non-clinging. So we inquire and we understand, and our understandings deepen and deepen and deepen. And so with our non-clinging mind, we begin to see, we see the self is shifting, changing. We see the emptiness of that. We see objects, we see the emptiness of that. We then see and know for ourselves with our non-clinging mind, we get a taste or a whisper even of that which is not bound to the conditions. This is the unconditioned. So we begin to see that there is a joy that isn't bound to the conditions, for example. We begin to see that there's a deep knowing that isn't bound up or attached to the shifting, changing nature of phenomena, the beginnings and the endings. This is deep Dharma teaching. So if that doesn't ring true for you right now, just listen, let it wash over you, and put it in the I will investigate this at some point box. So for some of you, it will be completely clear what I'm saying. It is understood experientially. It's not understood by thinking about it. So just listen to it. The Buddha encouraged us in the text to take our attention from the world of appearances. So not to be caught up in the world of appearances and turn towards the deathless. That's an instruction in the text. So this is a task for us. If it's your first retreat, you might like to leave that for later on. It's okay. So how does this apply to daily life, you might be wondering? It might be sounding very philosophical. I know that here in Israel there's been very troubled times, and many of you have felt distress and lots of stress and difficulty. So as well as, of course, the political difficulties, there's all sorts of other difficulties, the ordinary difficulties of life. As many of you have families where somebody is ill. Some of you are ill yourselves with difficult and painful bodily conditions. So there's illness. There's all the dramas that come with families and people we love. The interpersonal conflicts, the differences of view. In Australia, we've had terrible floods and fires. We had the fires first and then we had floods. The city nearest to me is still in a great state of disrepair. The whole central city was flooded with water to a depth that was, I think it was 14 and a half meters deep. It was 4 or 5 meters deeper than any flood in recorded history. And it came suddenly during the night without warning. And so you can imagine what happened. There were people stuck in the cavity in the roof because their entire house was flooded. Then they had to break open the roof from inside if they could in order to be rescued in the floodwaters. What was extraordinary was that people came. Anybody who had a boat came and the emergency services were just hopeless. They had only 2 boats for a whole city. And so people just ignored the police directives to stay out of the floodwater and they rescued each other. It was extraordinary. And so there were thousands of people homeless, thousands of people rescued, being brought to the university in a makeshift center where they could sleep and be fed. So you can imagine what happened. And in the aftermath of the flood, when the floodwaters went down, so many houses are just completely and utterly ruined. The whole central part of the city is now closed. Nobody knows what to do. So this is just one incidence of this changing world that we're living in. And we wonder how we can possibly meet life and deal with these incredible disasters that are coming upon us. Prior to that, we had the most horrendous fires we ever had in Australia. Rainforest that was original rainforest was on fire. It's usually so wet you can't stand up. So climate change is here and with it such a threat to all of us. So the question becomes, how can we face all of this with open-heartedness? How can we face it intelligently? How can we face it wakefully? So what helps? Courage, steadiness, and wisdom in the face of uncertainty, in the face of the unknown. In fact, it's the absence of the floods of the mind that help. So when the mind is calm, when the mind is steady, we can then step out of our sense of helplessness. So the Dharma, of course, is a foundation, that which supports us as we face devastating circumstances. So it's important that we each learn how to fearlessly love without being overcome by the suffering of the world. This is our challenge. A friend of mine, another Dharma teacher, Tanisara, writes a quite complex sentence which I've already asked a liar to translate. I'll read it to you. I think she's kind of nailed it when she's reflecting on humanity. She's reflecting on where we are as a human race at this time in our evolution. And she says, at this inflection point, so it's like a crossroads, we're at a really important point, a significant point in our planetary journey. We are caught between regressive divisive forces. So we're caught by our old systems of the past. And these systems of, you know, structures in society and so on have been based on division. And these forces from the past are energized by fear. Then she moves to the new possibility, a way of being that's in accordance with a longing that we feel. She says, on the one hand, there's the divisive forces and fear of the past. On the other, there's an evolutionary longing to leap beyond old painful systems. So in our society, to leap beyond. Leap is a jump. Jump beyond old painful systems of extraction. So here she's referring to how we treat the earth. We take what we need. In Australia, of course, we have huge mines and coal mining, gas mining that's ruining the planet, ruining the earth itself. And she says this is destroying the earth. So in other words, what she's saying is we're at a critical point where we need to shift from the old ways of doing things to the new. Do you want to translate? At this
I think it was quite clear.
Okay. You got it? Oh. Okay. Okay, so we're shifting from the old destructive ways where everything is for our own gain. So it's, you know, greed for the minerals of the earth. There's also, you know, systems where whole societies are oppressed, like the diamond mining in Africa, for example, and so on. So she's referring to this and referring to the way that we do not look after this earth of ours, which supports us. So we are at a point where we require a shift in consciousness in order for us to survive. Now here I'm going to read you something from one of my Dharma teachers. About 45 years ago, there was an extraordinary woman called Vimala Thakur. She was an Indian woman, and she was remarkable. She was, at first, a social activist. She walked across India after Gandhi's assassination as part of the land rights movement. What happened in India is that there were different castes of people, and those with wealth and land had the lower caste people, called then, not now, but called then the untouchables, work for them. They were essentially slaves, in that no matter how hard they worked, they could never gain anything for themselves and their families. They were always poor. And so what these people decided to do after the death of Gandhi was to walk across India, listening to the needs of the people. So they went village by village. They went to the first village. They sat down. They had all the people come, sit in a circle under a tree. This is the power of listening. And so they listened. And then They came up with a plan that would involve the government redistributing land. And then they realized that in India that just was not going to work. Because by the time it went from this person in the bureaucracy to the next, to the next, to the next, there would be nothing left of the money by the time it reached the people at the bottom. So they had to say, okay, I'm sorry, this plan we had of a new order isn't going to work. And so what they did then was they just listened. They listened to the people's needs. And then one man offered some land. He said, how much land do you need? And they said they needed 80 acres of land to give each poor person 5 acres of land on which to grow food. So that was the beginning of the biggest land redistribution in the history of humanity. They went village by village. They listened to one another, the poor and the rich sat together. They listened, and those with land donated the land to those who did not have it. Extraordinary. Absolutely extraordinary. So this was Vimala. And then after that, she met Krishnamurti. And she said she describes her experience of, she never regarded Krishnamurti as her teacher, actually, because as from a young age, she had had very spiritual experiences. When she was about 6 or 7 years old, she went into the forest looking for God. And her father, a Hindu man, encouraged her to follow her own path. And so she was, for her time, the most extraordinarily liberated woman. She'd been able to live in India just as she wanted. So she wasn't married. She didn't have to do any of the conventional things. She was really free to follow her own spiritual path, which she did. So she had all sorts of deep revelations. And then Krishnamurti encouraged her to travel the world speaking. And so she did. And luckily for me, she actually came to Australia and she stayed in the community in which friends and I lived, a Dharma community. And she was fabulous, I've got to say. She was wonderful. And this is what she said 45 years ago, and it could have been written yesterday. She said, when awareness of the totality of wholeness dawns upon the heart, and there is awareness of the relationship of every being to every other, then there is no longer any possibility of taking an exclusive approach, so a self-centered approach, to a fragment and getting stuck there. So when we start to really see the boundless nature of the heart, the expansiveness, it informs us really about how to live. We reflect on it, we inquire, and insights begin to come. We directly experience the interdependence of all things. Vimala says, as soon as there is awareness of wholeness, every moment becomes sacred. Every movement is sacred. The sense of oneness, which is what she called it, is no longer an intellectual connection. We will in all our actions be whole, total, natural, without effort. Every action or non-action will have the perfume of wholeness. I love that, the perfume of wholeness. So when we act in accordance with our understanding, so many of you have had this experience of the expansiveness of consciousness, of the self that's no longer self-centered, but larger. So when we know this, we touch the sacred, the perfume of wholeness is there. She goes on. She says, a tender, loving concern for all living creatures will need to arise and reign in our hearts if any of us is to survive. 45 years ago, she wrote that. And our lives will be truly blessed only when the misery of one is genuinely felt to be the misery of all. So until we really have empathy for the other, our lives will not be truly blessed. And then she says this fabulous line, the force of love is the force of total revolution. It's the unreleased force, unknown and unexplored as a dynamic for change. It's not sufficient that a few in society penetrate to the depths of living and offer fascinating accounts of the oneness of all beings. You can laugh, it's okay. What is necessary in these critical times is that all sensitive and caring people make a personal discovery of the fact of wholeness and allow compassion to flow in their lives. Wise words. She says, when compassion and realization becomes the dynamic of human relationship, then humankind will evolve. So this is our task. Our task is to trust the unreleased force for revolution, force for change, the force that can bring in the new in order for us as human beings to evolve. It's the revolution of consciousness. It's the inner climate change that we need, as well as a wise response to the outer climate change. So love is a liberating force. Love liberates and is liberating. We saw today, love liberating, love freeing up in the inquiry. Vimala says, love asks nothing, is fulfilled in itself. Beautiful. When we really get that, life is different. So here I'm going to read a poem about love, just to give you a break from deep dharma. And it's by the Chilean poet Pablo Neruda. I love you without knowing how, or when, or from where. I love you straightforwardly, without complexities or pride. So I love you because I know no other way than this, where I does not exist nor you, so close that your hand on my chest is my hand, so close that your eyes close as I fall asleep. Beautiful, isn't it? Recently in Australia, there was a fantastic documentary about Julian Assange. Do you know who Julian Assange is, by the way? No. Some do, some don't. Okay, Julian Assange is an Australian man who was the WikiLeaks publisher, who is now in prison in the UK, facing an extradition to the US to be charged. He sought asylum in the embassy in London, the Ecuadorian embassy, for some years. So these files, which included some film and footage of American soldiers in Afghanistan and all kinds of other kind of sensitive material, were all true and released publicly. He was in danger of being arrested, and he was finally arrested, and he's been in prison in London for 4 years. He grew up very close, not far from where I live. And so we as Australians are wanting him to come back to Australia, wanting him to be brought home. We figure that whatever opinion people have of him, he has suffered enough. His father, whose name is John Shipton, has been traveling Europe, speaking in public places, speaking to leaders of various countries, trying to get support for his release. Julian's fiance and mother of two children, her name is Stella, she's from Spain, has also been traveling the world, trying to get him released from prison, or at least brought back to Australia. And the film, the documentary, is incredibly moving, and it has much, much more detail than you'll find in the ordinary media. So it's, I don't know if it's available here, but it was a wonderful documentary of the whole event. So you can imagine his father's feeling. His son has been imprisoned. He's been charged with, I think the US has charged him with at least 17 different charges of espionage. He would be in prison for the rest of his life if he's taken to the US. He's not an American citizen, but still, this is what's been happening. So his father says this. He says, when someone asked him what it was like campaigning to have his son released from prison after so long, and he said, you find yourself not procrastinating, just taking what comes towards you in the stream of life without opinion and prejudice, and just doing what you can with what comes towards you. Not being frightened is a great help. And then he says something that almost makes me weep. He said, we have taken upon ourselves the sacred and noble task to bring Julian home. Whether we succeed or not is not significant. It's of course significant in terms of Julian. What is supremely important is accepting and taking on the task. Wow. Which means when we face a difficulty in life, we accept and take on the noble task to reduce suffering. We face it with right intention. Yet we don't know the outcome. We don't know what the outcome of our actions will be. He says, what keeps you calm is a particular sort of energy, an energy which is a return on the energy you invest in what you are doing. So, being fearless, taking on the noble task to reduce suffering. So as Vimala did, she responded both to physical poverty and to spiritual poverty. She took upon herself the noble task of reducing suffering. So the Dharma urges each of us to be engaged in whatever way we can, in small ways and big, to engage, to inquire, and to act in a way that it reduces the suffering of another. This is our challenge. This is our task as Dharma practitioners. This is the noble task. So the invitation is to really live true to the deep knowing, the deep wisdom of the heart, the wisdom that's not bound anywhere. And then the peace, of course, the peace we discover when we look in this way, when we see in this way, the peace we discover releases new energies which spring from relaxation of the mind. So the mind is relaxed. We touch non-dual wisdom, so wisdom that's not based on the division into self and other. And when we just rest into this with the awareness that Ajahn Jumnian was talking about, what comes is the possibility of the new energies, the new movement forward for humanity. This is our task. It's up to us. It's up to us to find a new way of living that's conscious, wakeful, aware. And then we know the blossoming of the unborn. Then we're informed. Our actions are actions that are in accordance with truth. We can't guarantee a particular outcome, but we can act with right intention and right action according to deep understanding. Let's just sit for a minute. sitting, anchoring beyond change. I'll read the Buddha's verse again. All conditioned things are impermanent. They are phenomena subject to birth and death. When birth and death no longer are, the complete silencing is joy. May all beings see into impermanence. May all beings realize the deathless Dharma. And may all beings live with a compassionate heart in an engaged way to relieve the suffering of the world. This is our noble task.